grave. Instead, my hand felt for the package that Suki and I had bound against my breast. I was almost halfway there before I dared to slow my horse to a walk. It was then, from behind me, that I heard the neigh of another horse. I reined Barney in and turned to face the oncoming rider. Of course it was Rankin.
"Well, Mrs. Pike," he said, "I was hoping that I might catch up to you. I was wondering where you were going at such a speed, but now that we are near his house, I'm not wondering no more."
He smiled.
"Will Stevens is quite a friend of yours, isn't he?"
When I did not answer, he reached for the reins of my horse and turned us toward home.
"You know your husband don't want you out here."
I cracked my whip smartly across his wrist. Barney, responding to the crop, jumped ahead, and I gave him his rein when he headed for home. I was ready for my husband when he came to my room that evening. At my request, Fanny had taken Ellie to the nursery for the night. Suki refused to leave my side, so she and I sat playing cards. When I heard Marshall's footsteps on the stairs, my hands began to tremble. Suki whispered,
"Don't worry, Miss Abby. I'm staying here with you."
"Please go. Stay with Mama," I whispered, but she shook her head. When Marshall entered, Suki rose, as was the order. Marshall strode over to me and slapped my face. Suki gasped.
"Where were you going?"
he asked. I kept my eyes down. "I went out for a ride." This time the force of his slap threw me from the chair. He came at me again, and before I could prevent it, Suki charged him. She bit deep into his arm, and Marshall yelled a profanity as he threw her from him. To my great surprise and relief, he abruptly left the room. Suki and I were comforting each other when Marshall returned with Papa George.
"Take her," Marshall said, waving toward Suki. "Get rid of her."
"No," I pleaded, holding Suki to me. "Please, Marshall, she did nothing wrong."
"You let your nigra bite me, and you say she did nothing wrong," he shouted.
"She was only trying to stop you."
"Stop me! Stop me!"
He turned to Papa, who was standing back at the door.
"George, I said get in here and take her out," he said.
Suki's arms were locked around me, but Marshall ripped her away and tossed her at Papa George.
"Get her out of here."
Papa's eyes flamed, and his body shook, and for one terrible moment I thought he might refuse Marshall's command. Yet he contained himself, and with an uncommon gentleness, he convinced Suki to come with him. I fell to my knees after they left. "Marshall, please, please don't harm her. Where will you send her?"
"She will go to the quarters, where she belongs."
"But what about Ellie?" I pleaded, trying another approach. "She is so attached to her."
"Ellie has others to care for her," he said.
"But Suki's never lived down there. It will be too hard on her."
"This is all your doing, Lavinia," he said. "You dare to embarrass me? You go to meet another man?"
Still on my knees, I begged him, "Please, Marshall, punish me, not Suki. Don't take her from me. She's like my own child." He kicked at me.
"Get up. You disgust me. The titles you give these niggers. You say she's like your child. You call them Papa and Mama like they are kin to you. More of this, and I will rid you of them all."
After he left the room, I ran to the window. Blackness loomed up and prevented me from seeing out. The house was quiet. No one dared stir. I locked my door before I went to my tall linen press. Shaking, I unwrapped Belle's papers from my bodice. When I hid them on the top shelf, I placed them behind the hat box that held the laudanum bottles. After little deliberation, I poured a generous amount of the black liquid into my sherry glass, drank it, and waited for it to quiet me. In the morning, Mama whispered to me that Suki had been taken to Ida's cabin and forbidden to bring any of her belongings. Everyone was warned that if they helped me contact her, they would be sold immediately. I remembered well the warning Marshall had given me. If he would take Suki away from me, I did not doubt he would remove any of the others. After that, I dared not question anyone about Suki. Desperate, I wrote to Mr. Madden, then remembered that Marshall was sure to intercept all of my correspondence, so I burned the letter later that night. Over the next weeks, I went to Marshall on two separate occasions to plead my case. On my first approach, Marshall warned me to let the subject go. The second time I again implored him to change his mind. He laughed bitterly at my attachment to Suki, calling her my long-lost child. "Who was her daddy?" he asked. Reckless in my desperation, I slapped him. I demanded that I be allowed to see her. He looked at me through eyes that I did not recognize. The next afternoon he sent Mama to tell me that Suki had been sold. Mama's eyes were swollen, and her face contorted when she gave me the news.
"I'm supposed to tell you that Suki gone."
"Gone where?" I wailed.
"She been sold."
"No, Mama, no. Not Suki, Mama, not Suki," I cried. But Mama was as grief-stricken as I, and she looked at me helplessly while tears streamed down her face. I ran to the window. Surely there was still time.
"They took her during the night. She gone," Mama said.
I stared at Mama, not willing to believe her. She came close to whisper in my ear.
"Miss Abinya, I got to go downstairs. Master Marshall waiting on me."
"For what, Mama?" I asked.
"He say he don't want me babying you no more. He say if I do, he gonna sell me next."
Her frightened face told me that she did not see this as an idle threat. I stared after her as she left the room. A wooden chair that stood against the wall felt weightless when I picked it up. I smashed it against the bed with such force that both the bedpost and the chair shattered. Still, I continued to batter away. When nothing was left in my hands, I sank to the floor and gave way to my grief. Following the sale of Suki, I refused to go to the dining room for my meals, and Marshall did not send for me. We did not see each other as I stayed upstairs when I knew he was about. Marshall had driven home his point. Everyone was afraid. After the sale of Suki, no one felt safe. I felt that my whole family blamed me for her exile, and why would they not? I was responsible. Furthermore, I was terrified that Marshall would misinterpret any exchange I had with them, so I kept any conversation brief. I grieved for Suki as I had no other, and ashamed of my part in the matter, I closed myself off from any consolation my family might have offered. In complete despair, I relied heavily on the laudanum. Soon I depended on it to function. I had already discovered that the drug was not difficult to obtain. It was easily ordered by mail. Every morning, dissolved in a glass of water, a few drops dulled my reality. Hours later, when exhaustion overtook me, another dose with wine gave me a boost to help me finish out the day. In the evening, alone in my room, I schemed. I would leave, find Suki, and help her to escape. Late into the night, I drew maps of the woods as I remembered them, planning our route, only to burn them for fear of Marshall's discovery. When sleep eluded me, a heavier dose of opium carried me into sleep. I continued this way, believing the opiate my friend, while its ever-tightening arms wrapped around me. During that time, Marshall continued on with Beatty, though he found other diversions as well. He began to bet on the horses, and he developed a passion for card playing. Fanny let me know that he sold people from the quarters to pay off debts. Meg wrote, and I ignored her pleas for communication. As my need for laudanum took over, I felt more helpless than ever, and with each passing year, I burrowed deeper into oblivion. I scarcely wept when Mama told me that Will Stevens had married.
Chapter 50, 1810, Bell. It's 5 years that Suki's gone. In that time, Beatty gets two more boys from Marshall. She got him figured out, and now he spends more time in the kitchen house than he does in the big house. Mama says if Marshall cares about anybody, it's Beatty. Beatty says he don't hardly even get on her no more. He just comes to sleep. Sometimes, she says, he even plays with the babies. Most times, though, he's too drunk to know where he's at. Will Stevens tells us that Marshall's losing the whole place from playing cards and betting the horses. He's getting rid of more and more land, and he's even selling off people from the quarters. I get worried that he'll sell my Jamie. But Will Stevens says that's never going to happen. Marshall knows Will Stevens is watching out to buy Jamie if that day ever comes. They tell me my Jamie's real smart. He reads all the time. Mama says he talks real good and sounds like he comes from the big house. They say he has no trouble passing for white. The times I miss him, I tell myself, maybe this is the way he'll get free. Maybe one day he'll go off and live like a white boy. They're saying Lavinia uses drops the same as Miss Martha. Lavinia is still up and moving around, but Mama says there's nothing coming from her eyes no more. The only thing she still cares about is her Ellie. That little Ellie, Mama says, sure is something. She looks like Lavinia, but she got more sass and spark in her than Lavinia ever have. Most of the time she's out running and playing with Moses, Beattie's oldest boy, but she gets along good with my Jamie, too. A couple of times I hide up in the trees, thinking to see Jamie when he goes down to the barns. But this last time, Papa says, don't come here no more. Rankin's got a nose for trouble. Ben says after Suki got sent off, Papa's scared of everything. Papa especially don't like it when he hears that Ben's helping people run. Ben fixed a place to hide them in his house, but we don't talk about that to nobody. We think maybe Will Stevens knows, but he don't say nothing. Lucy don't like it one bit. She's afraid for her little ones. This place here is growing. Will Stevens finally got married. We all know he was waiting to see what's happening with Lavinia. One time Will goes over there to see how she's doing. He goes to the front door like a gentleman and asks to see Lavinia. Marshall comes to the door, puts a gun to Will, and tells him he'll shoot the next time he sees him. When Will sees for himself that he can't do nothing, he don't go back. Last year he marries a girl at church, and we all like her good enough. For sure, she nothing smart to look at. She's real white, with yellow hair, and she looks like she don't have no eyelashes. She don't laugh too much, and she sure does talk about the good Lord even more than Mama may ever done. Don't you know her name's Martha? So here I go, calling another woman Miss Martha. Lucy works up at the big house. I stay down here doing the cooking and looking out for the babies. Lucy's happy. She says never in her whole life did she think that she'd get to work in a big house. I say I never did think that I'd be working in a kitchen and looking out for babies that some women have with my man. We laugh, 'cause it's the sorry truth. Ben means everything to Lucy and me. But some days Lucy comes and says, Belle, you take that man. I don't ever want to see him again. Other times I say, Lucy, he's all yours. Keep him away from me. So that's the way it works out for us, both with the same man. Course, there's times I think Ben wants a place for himself to get away from two women who each got their own way. My George is going to be 6 years old this Christmas. He writes his name already and my name too. He called me Mama Bells, and the way he says it, those two words I can never hear enough. He lives with me from the time before he can walk, and Lucy don't never say she don't want me taking over this child. Ben asks, what you gonna do when it's time for him to work the fields? I say, I'm getting George ready for the big house. He's not going down to those fields. Ben and Lucy think that George takes the place of my Jamie, but they don't see it right. Each boy got half my heart.
Chapter 51. 1810. Lavinia. Much of the land was sold by the spring of 1810. I kept myself dosed with laudanum as everything fell away. Marshall was seldom present on the farm, and the few times when I did see him, our meetings were cold and brief. I made sure that Ellie was taken to her father when he asked to see her, but those times were infrequent. Fanny, who accompanied Ellie on these visits, told me that Marshall appeared ill at ease with his daughter.
He don't know what to say, 'cause the older that little girl get, the more she look like you, Fanny explained.
My daughter was the light of Fanny's world. To Fanny's sorrow, she and Eddie did not have children, so she treated Ellie as her own. Every morning after Fanny fed and dressed Ellie for the day, they had their own small ritual.
And who is Fanny to her little darling?
Fanny would ask. Ellie's arms would go around her neck for their morning hug, and her words always made Fanny laugh out loud. Ellie would draw out the words and mimic her perfectly.
Fanny, you know you just my best blessing.
Fanny was also Miss Martha's nurse. On the whole, my mother-in-law's mental health had stabilized. There were days, though, when the sharp cry of an animal from the outdoors might cause her extreme alarm. She would call for me then.
Isabel! Isabel!
And if I did not come running, the only other who could settle her was Jamie. She was as obsessed with Jamie as ever, and though I knew its eccentricity in that unusual household, it no longer seemed that peculiar. Jamie was 13 years old that summer. The previous spring he had grown very tall. He had a thin build, and but for his one eye, a beautiful face with finely carved features. Fanny best described him to Mama.
He too pretty for a boy, she said.
Jamie was unusually fastidious. He insisted that his clothes fit perfectly, and he always kept his softly curled hair carefully tied back with a black satin ribbon. I tried to love him as I did Ellie, but there was something about him that would not let me close. He was never disagreeable with Miss Martha, nor was he to me, but if anyone else crossed him, he would call up an air of superiority that caused Mama to remark more than once that he was thinking too high on himself. Through the years, Papa tried to interest Jamie in outdoor activities. He taught Jamie to ride, and when Marshall was away, he even taught him to hunt with the shotgun that was kept locked in the barn. But Jamie's time with Papa was limited, and for the most part Jamie remained indoors. His passion was books, and he spent hours at a desk in the blue room where he read, wrote, and studied poetry. His other fascination was with birds. In this he often reminded me of Meg. Jamie's most prized possession was a book about North American birds that I had given to him. After days spent poring over the book, he announced that one day he would go to Philadelphia to meet the ornithologist who had published it. His determination left no doubt that he would make it happen. The blue room held stacks of other books, and it became routine in the evenings to gather in Miss Martha's room and listen as Jamie read aloud. Miss Martha had coached him, and his elocution was superb. In many ways those evenings saved me. Uncle Jacob always came to my room to fetch me. If I argued lethargy, if I told him that I was not feeling well, one look from his old brown eyes was enough to remind me of my duty to the household. I was often in a stupor when I took his arm, and he led me to Miss Martha's rooms. After he would seat me, he'd pull a wooden chair from the blue room and sit quietly behind me. The evening almost always ended with Ellie dozing on Uncle Jacob's lap. Beattie and Marshall's oldest child, Moses, was 6 years old that summer, a year younger than Ellie. They were constant playmates. In the first years, Beattie tried to keep Moses from the big house, but after a time Mama May must have told her that I did not care if he came to play with Ellie. In truth, Moses, with his easygoing manner and his deeply dimpled face, so reminded me of Beattie as a child that I welcomed his happy presence. I no longer concerned myself on Beattie's behalf. I knew that she had found her own way of coping. I was happy to learn that she invited Ellie into the kitchen house and treated her there with kindness. Beattie and I saw little of each other, as I no longer went down to the kitchen house. I never knew when Marshall was about. In the last month of the summer of 1810, Marshall was seldom home. His drinking and gambling had worsened, and I could only guess how close we were to complete disaster. That summer many of our workers had already been sold, and the few people left in the quarters were so worn out that I do not know how they survived. I saw no way out. Tormented by my inability to act, I paced in an opium haze during the night when everyone slept. Where was the solution? Marshall was aware of all my expenditure, so how could I finance an escape? And overcoming that, whom would I take with me? There were Ellie, and of course her beloved Fanny. But what of Miss Martha? I felt extremely protective toward her. And Mama May, how could I leave her? She was my foundation, and I could not envision life without her. In these later years, I had only two disagreements with Mama. One was about Jamie. The other had to do with my laudanum use. All along, I knew of Mama's objection to Jamie's presence in the house, and the resulting dependency between Miss Martha and Jamie. Whenever Mama suggested that we separate the two, I always pleaded for more time. I could not forget Miss Sarah's visit, and the disastrous results when Jamie was removed for those few days. Besides, Jamie was as attached to Miss Martha as she was to him. They spent long hours in each other's company, though Miss Martha often slept while Jamie wrote or studied. Jamie was always respectful toward me, but there were times, after his 13th birthday in particular, when he was particularly insolent with Fanny. I corrected him, but he continued until Fanny finally complained to Mama May. On an early morning that May, at Mama's request, I went downstairs to help her open the house to the spring air. We pushed open the dining room windows. The room was seldom used these days, and as I looked it over, I noted its grandeur was beginning to fade. Mama stood quiet as I looked around. As I made to leave, she asked if we could speak. I pulled a chair out for Mama, and then seated myself. "What is it, May?" I asked.
"We got to get Jamie out of this house," she said urgently.
I shifted in discomfort. I had managed to evade this discussion many times, but hearing Mama's tone, I doubted I could do so now. I brushed my finger to and fro along the edge of the polished dining table until Mama interrupted me.
"Miss Abenya?"
"But why now?" I heard the whine in my voice.
"'Cause trouble just waiting on this. I can feel it."
"Well, what can we do? Where would he go? We can't send him back to the kitchen house. Marshall goes there all the time."
"Jacob say he take him in his house, and George say he take him to work out in the barn. He say Jamie good with the horses."
"But you know Jamie won't want to work in the barns."
"That why he need to go. He growing up fast. He need to know his place."
"But what is his place? I doubt he even remembers Belle."
"Last time Jamie down at the barns, Papa talked to him about Belle being his real mama. Jamie get mad, say Papa don't know what he talking about. Jamie say he a white boy. Papa say, no, you a nigger just like me. Jamie go running off, and now he don't go down to the barns no more. He getting too old for this, Abenya, and his mouth getting too smart. It time he know he a negra, he got to learn to work like one."
"I know you all right, May. I've heard him with Fanny. But you know that Miss Martha thinks of him as her son? It's no wonder that he feels he belongs up here in the big house."
"It got to end. These days he thinking too much on himself. They're gonna be a big come down for that boy," Mama said.
"Maybe we could send him off. He looks white. You would never guess—"
"His mama, Belle, that make him a negra. Sides, he got no freedom papers."
"Do you think he knows who his father is?"
"All that boy got to do is see his own face. If he don't look like Master Marshall, then I don't know who do. All along, that why Miss Martha thinking he one of hers."
"I know we've got to do this, but I'm so afraid of how Miss Martha—"
"Jamie still come up to see her," Mama reassured me.
"Can we wait a few weeks? Summer will be here in a month, and in the heat she sleeps most of the day. She might not miss him as much." Mama was silent. "I promise that if you agree to wait until June, I will speak to Jamie then."
"I counting on you for this," she said.
I gave her my word. We did not know that Jamie, on his way out of the house, had listened to our conversation. Following that morning, Jamie became moody and sullen. Often he left the house in the early morning and stayed away all day. On his return, he stubbornly refused to tell anyone his whereabouts. I wondered if he had somehow gained knowledge of the impending change I wondered, too, exactly what he knew of his parentage. On the 1st of June, I knew I must uphold my promise to Mama. That morning, Jamie was alone with Miss Martha. Knowing that the others were down in the kitchen house, I bolstered my courage with a dose of laudanum, then went in to see him. Miss Martha had been upset by his absence in the past few weeks, and this morning she was clearly overjoyed to have him at her side. When I asked Jamie if, on Fanny's return, I might have a word with him, his face paled, and I felt my resolve weaken. I went back to my room to await Fanny's return, and decided to give myself yet more courage. I found that the small brown bottle at my bedside was empty. Quickly, I pulled up a chair to get another from the back of the linen press where I kept a supply. I was already unsteady on my feet, and the chair wobbled under me as I reached for a bottle. My fingers felt the envelope that contained Belle's papers. Suddenly inspired, I pulled them out, thinking they might somehow help Jamie understand something of his true mother. Jamie startled me when he unexpectedly opened the door. I swung around, clutching the air as the chair wobbled, then I tumbled over. Before I crashed, Belle's envelope flew out of my hands. When my head cracked against the hardwood floor, I lost consciousness. As Marshall was not at home, Mama took it upon herself to send for the doctor. After the examination, Mama was instructed to observe me closely and not, under any circumstances, to give me laudanum. A day later, I woke with a terrible headache. My body trembled at the slightest sound, and I ached in every bone. I pleaded with Mama for laudanum. She was firm in her refusal, and for the next week, I was too ill to argue. When Marshall came home at the end of the week, he was informed of my accident, but did not feel the need to see me. Now, though, I began to plead in earnest with Mama for laudanum. Tired of my begging, she stood at my bedside.
"You don't get the drops from me no mo," she said, "and that be that."
I had no choice but to acquiesce to her dictate, and each day following I began to feel somewhat better. One day I had a visit from Fanny, and after one of her candid observations, I laughed aloud. After she left, I heard her say to Mama,
"Maybe that bump on her head do her some good.
She's sounding again like the girl I grow up with."
"You're right," Mama said. "I just hate to think when that doctor come and say she can get those drops again."
It was weeks before the dizziness passed, enough that I could be seated in a chair. For the first few minutes the room whirled, but eventually steadied itself. That day, on Ellie's insistence, Mama brought her to me. I heard Mama instruct my daughter before entering the room.
"Now you don't go upsetting her, else she wantin' the drops again."
The word struck me like a blow. I had no idea that Ellie knew I used laudanum. As my daughter cautiously approached me, my heart ached at her fear for me, and I smiled to reassure her.
"Are you finished being sick?" she asked.
"I am almost well, sweetheart." I reached for her small hand. "May said that tomorrow I'm going for a walk."
"Will you be all better then?"
"I believe I will," I reassured her.
"Will you take the drops again?"
Her voice shook.
"The drops? Why do you ask, darling?" "I don't like it when you take drops," she said.
I forced myself to ask the question.
"Why don't you like it, Ellie?"
I saw that it took all of her courage to tell me.
"Then you sleep all day, or else you cry and tell me to go away."
Her eyes filled with tears and her chin quivered. "Come here." I opened my arms to her. As I held her, she sobbed without restraint. Her tears opened me to a painful truth. In my selfish escape, I had abandoned my own child. "Do you know, darling," I said, "May and I were just talking about those drops today. I do believe that I will not take them any longer. Truly, I am feeling so much better." I took her face in mine and smiled. "Can you imagine? Your mother needed a good bump on her head to make her feel better." I reassured her that she was not to worry, that Mama May was taking excellent care of me, and that I would soon be back on my feet. I was drained after Ellie left, but as Mama helped me back into bed, I made her promise to keep the drops away from me. Mama looked unconvinced. I asked her to bring Fanny to my room, and after she did, I asked the two of them to give their word that should I ask, they would refuse me the drops. They exchanged a skeptical look but gave me their promise. As a gesture of good faith, I told Fanny where I kept the extra bottles and asked her to retrieve them. When she was up on the chair, reaching to the back of the shelf, I had a momentary recall of Belle's papers. I quickly decided that if Fanny brought them down, I would show them to Mama. I had forgotten that they had flown out of my hand with my fall, and I did not know that they were already in Jamie's possession. When Fanny pulled out only the laudanum, I was so caught up in getting rid of the drug that I decided to tell Mama later about Belle's papers. And I would have done so had the withdrawal from the drug been less difficult. Though I was determined to follow through on my promise to Ellie, I couldn't have known that as my physical strength returned, so too would my obsession to take the drug. In the weeks that followed, in my darkest hours, I pleaded for release from my promise, but Mama refused me. At night, she slept on Suki's cot, and during the day she would not leave me alone. After a time, Mama began to insist that I walk outdoors with her. I was reluctant to go, afraid of seeing Marshall, but she assured me that he was seldom home. When I relented and ventured forth into the healing sun, I realized how much of a recluse I had become. Then came the day when we walked to the barn to see Papa George. He greeted me so warmly that I wondered why I hadn't come to see him sooner. I was surprised at the gray in his hair and told him so.
"Yep," he said,
smiling and brushing his worn hand over the top of his head.
"Time passing."
He looked into my eyes, then nodded his approval.
"It's so good to see Arabinia again," he said,
and I knew that the use of my childhood name was intended. I wanted to hug him, but I knew that such a gesture could place us both in jeopardy. I spoke instead of the hot weather, and of how the dry brown grass was in such need of rain that it crackled underfoot. I remarked that the sound reminded me of walking on dry leaves. Mama and Papa agreed, and I recalled the first dance that I had attended with them down in the quarters. I had a fond memory of watching the two of them dance together. That set us to remembering other good times, and as we did so, I was reminded of the many years they had cared for me. "Mama, Papa," I blurted out, "I'm so sorry about Suki." They looked at each other. Then Papa spoke.
"We all sorry about Suki, but we know you don't mean her no harm. We know you do the best you can when it come to Suki. Now we asking the Lord to make you strong again. We here all needing that."
"Thank you, Papa," I said. That day, with Papa's words of forgiveness, my obsession for the drug began to recede.
Chapter 52, Belle. Early morning, beginning of August, I'm working in the garden. It's so hot and dry this year, all I seem to do is carry water. I look over and got to smile at George playing the fool with the babies, splashing water on them, keeping them happy. All the time, though, I got this feeling somebody's watching. I stop, look around. Nothing there, but I feel it strong. When it's time to eat, I bring out the food, and we all sit outside by the kitchen house. Today I don't need to cook for the big house. Just send up soup from yesterday and some biscuits from this morning. Lucy comes down from the big house to eat with us and to feed her last baby. I fix her some butter and ham on a thick cut of bread and give it to her to eat while she's feeding. I know she's hungry, 'cause nobody likes food the way Lucy do. "Ain't we having those pickled cowcumbers today?" she asks. "Sure," I say, "I get them." I go in, take down a jar, and cut up a few, then bring them out. This time for sure, I know somebody's watching. Again, I look around, but I see only Lucy eyeing the pickles. Then I start to laugh. "Oh, no," I say, looking hard at her. "You getting big again, Lucy? Last time you wanted those pickles morning and night." Lucy rolls her eyes and says, "Up at the big house, Miss Martha calls it a blessing. I calls it more work." I laugh again, but truth is, I feel sorry for her. Her last one's still nursing. You know you got me to help, I say. If you not here, Belle, I don't know what I'd do. You like a sister to me. Lucy's eyes fill up. This happens easy when she's getting big. Her tongue gets sharp, too. Ben comes to me some days, says he don't know what's going on with her. I say, you try walking around big as a privy in the Virginia sun, and we'll see how much singing you do. How's Will's Martha doing? I ask Lucy. She doing better, but the more her stomach grow, the more her legs get big. Her head hurting, too. That stuff the doctor give don't do her no good. Maybe make it worse. I say, next time Fanny comes, I'll ask if Ida got something for that. Maybe she'd try it? Maybe she do. I know she's scared. Her own mama die like this when she have her last one, Lucy say.
I sure do hope that this baby comes easy, I say.
You know it's gonna be on us to help her out. Maybe we get Mama May over. I shake my head. It's too hard for her to get here. Last time Eddie's here, he says there's so much trouble going on over there that everybody's scared to walk out. Marshall already sells most everybody from the fields. Lucy asks real quiet. You worried about your Jamie? I nod, cause sometimes just saying his name hurts too much. I can't sleep some nights thinking about him, I say. But Will Stevens promised me that if Marshall ever sells Jamie, he'll find him and get him for me. Lucy hands the baby to me. I got to get back up there, she says. I head into the kitchen house, turn back to tell George to watch the little ones. And out the corner of my eye, back in the trees, I see a boy. Just for a minute, mind you. He sees me looking and he's gone. I got to sit. My heart's pounding so hard. It's my Jamie. I know it's my Jamie. Next morning, I go to the garden and tell George to stay back in the house with the little ones. He don't like it, but I say, you do this, and later, I'll make those sugar cakes you like. He's still not happy, but he'd do almost anything for my sugar cakes. That way, he's just like Lucy. I pick up my hoe, and facing the trees, I chop away at the weeds. Sure enough, there he is. I keep my head down, look at the dirt, and start to talk real loud. If that's Jamie Pike in those trees, I say, he don't have to be scared. I'm gonna keep weeding my garden. But I sure do wish Jamie Pike would come over here and show me what he looks like now that he's a grown boy. I don't look up, just keep working my hoe. But I hear him coming out the woods and walking toward me. I don't know why he's scared of me. But when he gets closer, I start feeling scared of him. What's he doing here anyway? What's he want? Are you Belle? He asks. I look up real slow, afraid he's gonna run. I hang on tight to my hoe, my head spinning, my mouth dried up. Standing there in front of me is a white man. My Jamie. 13 years old. Not a boy, not a man. I is, I say. Quick, he holds out some paper.
Then this is yours, he says. I believe these are your emancipation papers.
I stand just looking at my boy's face. I don't hear what he's saying. I got to take him in.
Here, he says. Take them. You're free.
I take the paper, my hand shaking. Jamie? I ask.
Yes,
he says. Do you know who I am to you?
Yes. You're my mother.
I nod.
I don't remember you, though.
That's all right, I say. You was little when he took you.
All of these years, Papa George told me, I thought I was Miss Martha's son. I looked good at him then.
He's white as Marshall, but Jamie got the same face of the captain's mama. Seeing his face in some way is like seeing my white grandma here again. I can't stop looking, but I know I got to say something. She don't know no better, Jamie. But Miss Martha, your grandma. Mama May says she's real good to you, and...
So it's true that Marshall is my father.
Yes, I say. He used me.
Lucy comes round the corner of the kitchen house calling out, saying she needs George to come help out in the big house. Jamie don't wait. He turns, and before I get a chance to say, it's all right, it's just Lucy, Jamie's gone. My whole body starts shaking. Lucy sees Jamie run off. Who that? Who that? She calls out when she comes huffing over. Lucy, shush, I say. Who that? She whispers real loud when she gets to me.
I hand her the papers. She opens them, looks real close, then gives them back.
You know I can't read, she says. What's a white man doing here talking to you for?
He gives me my free papers, I say. I look off, hoping Jamie's still in the trees, but my heart tells me he's gone. That's my Jamie. I sit right down in the dirt and start to cry. I go to see Will Stevens that night. He looks over my papers and says,
Well, Belle, this means that you are a free woman.
But you give a lot of money for me, I say.
And every penny was worth it, he says.
If I stay and work real hard for you, can you give me money to buy Jamie?
I don't think that Marshall will sell him. But in a court of law, these papers just might be enough to set him free.
He'd kill my boy before he'd give him papers. Marshall needs money real bad, and I'm thinking if I pay him enough for two people, he'll let Jamie go. Will shakes his head.
It would take you a lifetime to pay off that kind of debt.
I got no place to go. The thing is, you want me. I'm asking to stay here anyway, I say. Will Stevens pushes hands through his hair the way he does when he's thinking.
I tell you what. I'm sure Lucy has told you that the doctor said I have got to take Martha to the mountains for a few weeks. He thinks the cooler air will make it easier for her. I'm leaving Ben in charge, and I need to count on you to support him. As soon as I get back, we'll deal with this. Then if you choose not to go through the court, I will find you the money. When you decide the action you want to take, we will send a solicitor with your proposal.
I keep myself from saying more. I know Will Stevens is good as his word. If he says he'll find me the money, then he'll find me the money. But I know for sure that his lawman will do no good. We tried that over and over. No, I know Marshall got to see me. He got to see me on my knees. The morning Will and Miss Martha drive out, it's so hot and dry. The wheels on the wagon sound like they're going over crackling. We all know Will don't want to leave this place, but he's the kind of man who'd do right by his wife. Almost 2 weeks go by. I know Will Stevens is coming back any day. Every morning I look out for Jamie, but he don't come back. After seeing my boy, I can't think of nothing else. I know I got to help him get him out of there, away from Marshall. I keep waiting for Jamie to show up so I can tell him about the money that Will's given me so I can get him free. When Jamie don't come, I think I got to get over there before Will gets back. I got it in my head that just maybe if I talk to Marshall, he'll see my way. I'll show Marshall my papers. Maybe even tell him the captain's my daddy. I wait until supper time when Ben and Lucy's eating. Then I send George over to them, say my head's hurting and I'm going to have a lay down. Then I head out. I walk fast and don't think about nothing so I don't get too scared to keep going. When I get there, I head right to the kitchen house. I count my steps to keep myself from turning back. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. I don't look around. I just watch my feet heading to the kitchen house. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Sure enough, there he is with Beatty. He don't say nothing, just stares at me. Scared as I am, I stare back. It's 5 years, maybe, since I see Marshall. I know he's got no more than 30 years on him, but he looks almost as old as the captain before he dies. Most of his hair is gone from the top of his head, and his color's more yellow than white. I know he's drinking because I can smell it coming off him. I walk over and hold open my papers for him to see. I say, "I'm a free woman, Marshall. Your daddy, he gives me the free papers a long time ago. Now I'm wanting to buy my Jamie from you. I'll give you the money for 2 strong men. Marshall's slow to stand, but when he does, his face gets all red. "Have you lost your mind?" he says. "What is she doing here?" He look around like there's somebody who's going to give him the answer. I keep talking. "I'm hoping it'll be all right with you," I say, "if I send Jamie to Philadelphia. He can live there like a white boy."
"Live like a... He's a Negro, you fool! He's a Negro!"
"But he's white as you. You're his daddy," I say. "It's time you stand behind that."
"Get out of here."
"Marshall," I say, "Jamie's your boy." Beatty's standing behind Marshall, shaking her head at me to stop talking. But it's too late. I'm gonna say what I got to say. "He's your boy, Marshall. What are you gonna do? Are you just gonna sell him like you're selling everybody else?" Marshall moves so fast that I don't see his fist coming. It hits so hard, everything spins.
"Where's my gun?" he starts hollering.
Beatty's yelling and crying and holding him back. "Run, Belle, run!" So I do.
Chapter 53, Lavinia. The air shimmered from the heat. One unbearably hot afternoon toward the end of August, I insisted that Ellie stay indoors away from the intense rays of the sun. Fanny sat with her, the two of them dressing Ellie's baby doll. Miss Martha was restless, and I tried to soothe her by reading aloud. Jamie, who had been out since early morning, had returned only a short while before. He sat slouched in a chair watching me. His attitude toward the new me, the person minus the laudanum, was wary. In return, I was watchful of him. I had searched my room for Belle's papers and realized they were missing. I guessed, by process of elimination, that Jamie had them in his possession, and though I wanted to query him, I was not in a hurry to confront this sullen boy. Jamie's disagreeable attitude baffled Miss Martha, and though he was still kind to her, he said not a friendly word to the rest of us. A few days before, I had gone to Mama May and brought up the subject of Jamie's presence in the house. I had told her that even I could see it was time for a change, and I was ready to carry through on the promise I had made. Still protective of my recovery, Mama suggested that I wait for another week to have my discussion with Jamie. She thought I should gain more strength to cope with not only Jamie's response, but Miss Martha's reaction as well. I was relieved, for I dreaded the outcome. My mother-in-law reached out her hand to stop my reading, then asked Fanny to readjust the window blinds to let in more of a breeze. As Fanny carried out the request, She peeked through the wooden slats. At her sudden cry, Jamie jumped up and ran to join her. His startled gasp had me put down my book. I went to the window as well. Rankin was down at the big barn alongside a rough-looking stranger. They had Eddie, Fanny's husband, tied between them, and while the stranger pulled, Rankin prodded the captive from behind. The blinds clanked as Fanny dropped the cord, and at once was outdoors, sprinting across the yard to her husband. She catapulted herself into the middle of the three men and threw her arms around Eddie to hold him back. Rankin yanked her away and shoved her to the ground as they pulled Eddie on toward the quarters. When Marshall came out of the barn, he was carrying a horsewhip. Fanny, who had fallen to her knees, begged his help, but he ignored her and strode on down the hill, following the men to the quarters. Fanny did not get up but knelt in the hot sun, staring after them until Beatty ran to her from the kitchen house. Within minutes, the two of them were with us in the bedroom. Fanny was frantic. "They're gonna sell him," she shook my arm. "They're gonna sell my Eddie. Please, please, Miss Albina, don't let that happen. He a good man, you know this. Please do something. Please do something, Albina." Miss Martha's voice was high and thin, but she spoke with authority. "Get the captain," she said. "I'm certain there's been a mistake." "No, no," Fanny bolted to Miss Martha's side. "They taken him. There no mistake, they taken him. Beatty say the nigger trader here. He sending them off." Mama May and Uncle Jacob, doing inventory down in the basement storage rooms, had heard the commotion and joined us. Mama's breathing was heavy, and she dropped onto the nearest chair. Fanny ran to her while Ellie, frightened at Fanny's distress, went to Uncle Jacob. "They got Eddie," Fanny sobbed. "That nigger trader here for Eddie. I think they taken others from the quarters, too." Beatty spoke for the first time. She whispered, "They take most everybody from the quarters. They all tied up. They leaving tomorrow." Unable to look at us, she covered her face with her hands and spoke through them. "I hear them talking. They talk about taking Mama and Jamie, too." Her muffled words were all too clear. I turned to Mama May. "That's impossible," I said. Mama May looked at me but didn't answer. "Somebody got to do something. They taken my Eddie," Fanny cried again. "For God's sake," I said helplessly, then turned to Beatty. "Do you know anything more? What else, Beatty?" "All I know is they getting most everybody from down the quarters ready to go in the morning, and they talk about selling Mama and Jamie." "That can't be. You're mistaken," I shouted, and stomped my foot. Beatty shook her head. She whispered, "No, Albina, I knows this. Master Marshall say if I tell about Mama and Jamie, he sell my boys." "And the others? Papa George, is Marshall planning to sell him too?" I asked. "No," Beatty said. "He say that he needin' him." "He can't do this." I clutched her arm and willed myself not to panic. Beatty spoke in a rush. "He say he needin' that money, that he got to sell. He say Mama getting old, but she still bring a good price. Fanny and Uncle here take care of the house. Master Marshall say he gonna sell Jamie after Belle come and tell him that she have her free papers, and that she wantin' to buy her Jamie. Master Marshall say he gonna sell her boy to make sure she don't get him." Mama May's face had turned ashen, and she looked as though she might topple off the chair. I rushed to her side. "Are you all right, Mama?" I asked. When she didn't answer, I grabbed the glass of water from Miss Martha's bedside stand and gave it to her. While she drank, I ran to look out the window. "Beatty," I said, "go back to the kitchen. He mustn't know that you were here. Go now while it's clear. Hurry, and say nothing."
"But Mama,"
Beatty began. Mama May finally spoke.
"Go, child. Go now, quick."
I pushed Beatty through the open door, then closed it behind her. "Jamie," I said, "you must go to Belle tonight." Miss Martha sat up and swung her legs over the side of the bed. She reached out toward Jamie, and he went to her side. "We'll hide you until dark," I said. "Mama, you'll have to go with him."
"That not gonna work," Mama shook her head. "That the first place Master Marshall look for me. I stay here. Jamie get to Bill. They get away.
Mama, please, I pleaded. You must go with them.
I stay in here, Abinya. I talk to Master Marshall. That the best way for me. I don't leave, George. Master Marshall know this.
Mama, please.
No, Abinya, I stay here, Mama May said. And that be that.
She leaned back heavily in her chair. Jamie knelt beside Miss Martha but looked at me. Should I go now?
No. We'll hide you until tonight. My mind frantically sought out a hiding place. The attic, the basement, the smokehouse. Suddenly there were loud voices, then footsteps on the stairs, and the bedroom door flew open before I could reach it. Rankin stood beside Marshall, his drunken smirk directed toward me.
Marshall, what in heaven's name? I asked.
Get her out of here, he said,
nodding toward Ellie. Uncle Jacob, who had taken the child onto his lap, began to rise, but I motioned for him to sit down again. No, Marshall, I said. I want Ellie here with me.
Very well, Marshall said. Suit yourself. Let her see the mess you've created.
His words were slurred, and even from a distance he stank of liquor. He strode over to Jamie and yanked him to his feet.
Boy, he said, you're coming with us.
Jamie was too frightened to react. Miss Martha straightened herself.
Sir, she said, in a formidable tone, send for the captain. He'll settle this.
Mother, I've had enough.
Marshall turned on her.
This is a negro's boy. Look at him. He's a negro.
He grabbed Jamie's neck and shoved his face toward her as Jamie cried out in pain.
Isabel!
Miss Martha screamed for me to intervene. Marshall, don't do this. I stepped forward and forced myself to speak calmly. Jamie means everything to her. Marshall tossed Jamie to the side and came toward me.
You've created this insanity, but it will stop. The boy is sold, he said.
My terror drove me to speak.
But Marshall, he is yours. You'd sell your own son.
There was an awful silence before I felt the crack of his hand across my face. My ears rang and it took a moment to balance myself. With all the fury from the years I had held back, I swung at him. My resounding slap surprised him, but Rankin's drunken guffaw enraged Marshall further. Before his hands could reach my neck, Mama May stepped between the two of us.
Master Marshall, you stop this, she said.
Marshall did stop, but his voice took on a deadly tone when he addressed me.
You are as insane as my mother. Prepare yourself. You'll be leaving in the morning. Both of you are going to the hospital in Williamsburg. I'll see to it that you'll never leave.
You wouldn't do that,
I said, knowing full well he had the authority to do so.
What of Ellie?
Fanny stays, he said.
Before I could respond, Marshall motioned Rankin toward Jamie. As Rankin pulled Jamie to her side, Miss Martha began a shrill scream. Jamie jerked away and went back to her. He dropped down and clasped her hands. Everyone watched, unable to look away.
Shh, grandmother, he said. It will be all right.
She quieted and he continued.
I'll come back for you, grandmother. I'll come back.
Then he stood of his own accord and fixed his one good eye on Marshall.
Get that nigra out of here,
Marshall shouted to Rankin. After they had gone, Mama May was the first to speak.
Abinya, she said, you gonna have to take Ellie and get to Will Stevens before it too late.
Miss Martha's wails had reached a familiar pitch, and I knew what to do. I mixed a heavy dose of the drops and water. The very smell offered the escape that I ached for, and though my hands shook with desire for the drug, I gave the drink to the woman who needed it and did not take any for myself. It was dark when I woke Ellie. As I dressed her, I explained that she must be very quiet, that she must not speak.
We are going on an adventure, I said.
Will Fanny come?
She asked as I fastened the buttons on her shoes. I put my finger to my lips and nodded. Mama May and Fanny came to the door. I could see their fear.
Hurry, Mama said. George say to come now.
Here. Fanny thrust a small sack into my hands, eager to release.